generous? I suggest.
You wish, Mr. Talcott, the judge says. I don't understand this whole good cholesterol, bad cholesterol thing, and I sure as hell don't understand why, if I'm going to eat a sandwich, I have to have a quarter of a teaspoon of peanut butter to go with it.
He takes a bite and grimaces.
You know why I'm going to lose weight on the zone diet? Because no one in their right mind would eat any of this crap.
He takes a deep, rumbling breath and shifts in his chair.
I don't normally hold hearings during my lunch hour, but I'm going to suggest to my wife that perhaps I should, because frankly, I find the subject of this motion so unpalatable that it has nearly ruined my appetite entirely. Why, if I got a dozen motions like this a day, my abs would look like Brad Pitt's.
Your Honor, Chris says quickly, intercepting.
Sit down, Mr. Hamilton. This isn't about you, and much to my chagrin, Mr. Talcott apparently has a mind of his own.
The judge levels his gaze at me.
Counselor, as I'm sure you're aware, witness tampering is one of the biggest ethical violations you can make as a defense attorney, one that will get your pro hac vice revoked and your ass kicked out of Arizona and most likely every other bar association in this country.
Absolutely, Judge Noble. I agree. But Ms. Wasserstein's allegations are false. The judge frowns.
Are you or are you not engaged to your client's daughter?
I am, Your Honor.
Well, maybe in New Hampshire you've all intermarried so much that everyone's a cousin, and there aren't enough non-related attorneys to go around for your clients. But here in Arizona, we do things a little differently.
Your Honor, it's true that I have a personal relationship with Delia Hopkins, but it will not affect this case in any capacity, in spite of Ms. Wasserstein's specious allegations. Yes, Delia asks me about her father, but it's how he looks and if he's being treated all right. Questions that would be important on a personal level and not a professional one.
We could ask Delia to corroborate that, Emma says tartly. But she's probably already been coached in what to say.
I turn to the judge. Your Honor, I'll give you my word. And if that's not good enough, I'll swear under oath that I'm not violating any ethical measures here. If anything, I have even more responsibility to my client because I'm trying to keep his daughter's best interests a priority as well.
Emma folds her arms above the shelf of her belly. You're too close to this case to do a decent job.
That's ridiculous, I argue.
That's like saying that you can't try a child kidnapping case because you're about to drop your own baby any second. And your emotions might keep you from being objective. But if I said that out loud, I'd be skating on pretty thin ice, wouldn't I? You'd accuse me of being prejudicial and sexist and outright anachronistic, wouldn't you?
All right, Mr. Talcott, shut your mouth before I wire your jaw closed for you.
Judge Noble orders.
I'm making a finding on this right now. Your first obligation is to your client, not your fiancé. However, the state has to show me that you're actively engaging in witness tampering for me to actually remove you from this case, and Ms. Wasserstein has not proven that yet. So you may remain Andrew Hopkins' attorney, Mr. Talcott, but make no mistake. Every time you come into my courtroom, I'm going to be watching you. Every time you open your mouth, I'm going to be caressing my rules of professional conduct. And if you make one wrong move, I'm going to refer you to the State Conduct Committee so fast you won't know what hit you.
He picks up his jar of peanut butter.
Oh, hell, Judge Noble says, and he sticks two fingers into the jiff and scoops out a dollop to eat. Adjourned.
When Emma Wasserstein gets up and drops her papers all over the floor, I lean down to grab them for her.
Watch your back, you hick, she murmurs.
I straighten. Excuse me?
The judge watches us over the rim of his glasses.
I said, "Nice comeback, Eric,"
Emma replies, and she smiles and waddles out of the room. When I get home, Sophie's in the front yard painting a prickly pear cactus pink. Her hands are small enough to weave the brush between the spines. I'm sure that in this state, what she's doing is probably a felony, but frankly, I'm not in the mood to take any more family members onto my caseload. I pull the car up beside our elongated tin can and step out into the searing heat. Ruth Ann and Delia sit on nylon-woven folding chairs in the dust between our trailers, and Greta is sprawled in an exhausted puddle close to the paint can. "Why is Sophie painting the cactus?" Delia shrugs. "Because it wanted to be pink."
"Ah."
I squat down next to Sophie.
"Who told you that?"
"Duh," Sophie says, with the kind of ennui that only 4-year-olds can pull off.
"Magdalena."
"Magdalena?"
"The cactus."
She points to a saguaro a few feet to the left.
"That's Rufus, and the little one with a white beard is Papa Joe."
I turn to Ruth Ann. "You name your cacti?"
"Of course not. Their parents do."
She winks at me.
"There's cold tea inside, if you want some."
I walk into her trailer and feel my way through the cabinets, past buttons and beads and rawhide-tied bundles of dried herbs, until I find a clean jelly jar, the pitcher of tea sweats on the counter. I fill my glass to the brim, and I'm about to take a sip when the phone rings. After a moment, I find the receiver under a stack of brown bananas. "Hello?"
"Is Ruth Ann Masawistiwa there?"
a voice asks.
"Just a sec. Who's calling?"
"The Virginia Piper Cancer Center."
Cancer Center? I step to the door of the trailer. "Ruth Ann, it's for you." She's wielding the paintbrush for Sophie, trying to work color under the tight armpit of the cactus.
"Take a message, Sikyaktavo. I'm busy with Picasso here."
"I think they really need to speak to you." She gives Sophie the paintbrush and steps into the trailer, letting the screen door slam behind her. I hold out the phone.
"It's the hospital,"
I say quietly. She looks at me for a long moment.
"Wrong number,"
she barks into the receiver, and then punches the off button. I'm quite certain that she doesn't realize she's folded her arm like a bird's wing, tucked over her left breast.
"We all have our secrets, I suppose."
She keeps staring at me until I incline my head just the tiniest bit, a promise to keep her confidence. When the phone rings again, she leans over and pulls the cord out of the wall.
"Wrong number," she says.
"Yes," I say quietly.
"It happens all the time to me."
The McCormick Railroad Park isn't crowded by the time we get there, just before sunset. With its combination playground, carousel, miniature steam engine ride, the sprawling recreational area is a hot spot for the kindergarten set. Delia invites Fitz to come along, and I invite Ruth Ann, who pulls her junk-lined trench coat out of her cavernous purse and begins to solicit her resale wares to tired mothers. I wait on the sidelines as Fitz and Delia take Sophie onto the carousel. She scrambles up onto a white horse with its neck straining forward.
"Come on," Fitz yells to me. "What have you got to lose?"
"My dignity?"
Fitz swings onto a powder pink pony.
"A guy who's secure in his manhood wouldn't be sitting out there like a loser."
I laugh.
"Yeah. And do you want me to hold your purse while you're on the ride?"
Sophie fidgets on top of her horse as Delia tries to strap her in.
"Nobody else has to wear the seatbelt," she complains.
Delia chooses a black stallion beside Fitz's.
I listen as the music tinkles to life and the carousel begins to vibrate. I won't admit this to any of them, but carousels scare the hell out of me. That calliope melody, and the way all the carved wooden horses seem to be in great pain, their eyes rolling wild, their yellow teeth bared, their bodies straining. As the carousel turns, the mirrored pillar in the center winks. Sophie comes into view and waves to me. Behind her, Delia and Fitz pretend to be jockeys, leaning forward on their horses. The acne-pitted kid manning the controls flips the switch, and the carousel begins to wheeze to a stop. Sophie leans forward, caressing the plaster mane. Fitz and Delia appear again, standing up in the stirrups for a last stretch at the brass ring. They're batting at each other's hands and laughing. There's an S-curved steel bar at the top of the carousel that makes one of their horses rise as the other falls. It looks like they're moving separately, but they're not. 2 days later, I land in the office of Sheriff Jack, head of the Maricopa County Jail System, and general media hound, with a personality so colorful he could give up his day job and become a disco strobe light. Everything I've heard about him is, regretfully, true. From the spittoon that he keeps on his desk and uses liberally, to the framed photos of himself with every living Republican president, to the bologna sandwich he himself eats for lunch, along with his prisoners.
"Let me get this straight," he says, his amusement booming from beneath his bristled mustache. "Your client refuses to see you?"
"Yes, sir," I say.
"But you wouldn't take no for an answer."
I shift on my chair. "I'm afraid not, sir."
"And Sergeant Concannon says that you..."
He looks down at a piece of paper in front of him.
"Sweet-talked her in an effort to get access to the inmate's pod."
He glances up.
"Sweet-talked?"
"She's a very handsome woman," I say, swallowing.
"She's a hell of a detention officer, but she's about as pretty as the business end of a donkey."
A man less tolerant than myself might consider that sexual harassment. The last thing I need is to have Sheriff Jack calling Judge Noble and having a little chat. "Well, sir," I say, "I find older women attractive, especially those who are diamonds in the rough."
"Sergeant Concannon's so rough, the carbons are still forming. Try again, boy."
"Did I mention I have a friend who's a journalist from New Hampshire's largest paper who'd like to write about you?" I will pay Fitz if I have to, hugely.
Sheriff Jack laughs out loud. "I like you, Talcott."
I smile politely. "About my client, sir."
"Sheriff Jack," he corrects. "What about him?"
If I could be brought up to his cell, even for 5 minutes, I think I could convince him that he ought to sit down with me for the sake of his own case.
We don't allow attorneys into the pods, unless, of course, they're criminals.
He thinks for a second.
"Maybe we should put the attorneys in the pods."
"Sheriff," I meet his gaze, "I'd really like to have the opportunity to speak to Andrew Hopkins." There is a beat of silence.
"A journalist, you said?"
"Award-winning," I lie. He gets to his feet.
"Oh, hell. I need a good laugh."
Sheriff Jack himself escorts me to the elevator, up to the second floor. This is different from the visitation room. Here, a central control tower monitors 4 spider arms that house the inmates. There are locks everywhere. Everyone knows who Sheriff Jack is as we walk through the halls. Detention officers greet him, but even more impressively, so do the inmates.
"Yo, yo, C-Rag," he says,
as we pass a man who's being signed into his pod again.
"Sup, dog?" the man replies, grinning.
Sheriff Jack turns to me proudly.
"I speak it all,"
Ebonics, Spanish, you name it. I can say, get your ass in line in 6 different languages.
He puts his hand on a doorknob that buzzes and then opens. Another inmate, this one wearing a pink tank top, slouches on a chair with his nose buried in the fountainhead. Up and down his arms, words are tattooed. Weissmacht.
Put your shirt on, Sheriff Jack orders.
We walk down a hallway that opens into a large 2-tiered room. Each side of the square holds an enclosed pod. Barred cells on top, a common area on bottom. What it resembles, what a jail always resembles, is a human zoo. The animals are busy doing their own thing, sleeping, eating, socializing. Some of them notice me, some of them choose not to. It's really the only power they have left. Sheriff Jack walks up into the control tower while I wait at the bottom of the stairs. A pair of black inmates start rapping, putting on a show for me.
I'm the OG, Mr. Womp, on the trigger nonstop, bust a cap on a cop and watch his punk ass drop. A 187, that's what it was, greeting all the homies with the word of cuz. I was dressed in blue since the age of 2, down for my hood, cause it's the thing to do.
To their right, an old man with white hair cascading past his shoulders is making elaborate hand motions to catch the attention of one of the detention officers. Behind the glass, his frail arm movements look like a modern dance performance. Suddenly, the sheriff is standing next to me again.
The good news is, your client isn't in there.
Where is he? Sheriff Jack smiles.
Well, that's the bad news, boy. Disciplinary segregation.
Disciplinary segregation is on level 3, house 2, in pods A and D. Andrew knows I'm coming before he sees me. Prisoners can sniff out lawyers at a distance, and my arrival has created a hum in the air. He stands with his back deliberately toward me as I am led to his cell.
I don't want to speak to him, Sergeant Doucette, he tells the detention officer.
She looks at me, bored.
He doesn't want to speak to you.
I stare at Andrew's back.
Well, that's fine by me, because God knows I don't feel like hearing what the hell landed you in lockdown.
He turns around and stares at me for a long moment.
Let him in.
Sheriff Jack has said nothing about me being led into a cell. I can see the detention officer thinking the same thing. If Andrew and I are going to have a traditional attorney-client visit, it's supposed to be upstairs in one of the conference rooms. Finally, she shrugs. If one lawyer gets strangled by his own client, the detention officers would probably consider it a good start. When she opens the barred slider, it grates like fingernails on a blackboard. I step into the tiny space, and Doucette rams the door home behind me. Immediately, I jump. Even knowing I can leave at any time, it's uncomfortable. There's barely enough room for one man, much less 2. Andrew sits down on the bunk, leaving me a small stool.
What are you doing in here? I ask quietly.
Self-preservation.
I'm just trying to save you, too.
Are you sure about that? Andrew says.
Time is elastic in jail. It can stretch the length of a highway.
It can beat like a pulse.
It can expand, a sponge, thick enough to make the few inches between 2 people feel like a continent.
I shouldn't have gotten angry at you the other day, I admit. This case isn't about me.
I think we both know that's a lie, Andrew says.
He's right. On all counts.
I am an alcoholic, representing a man who ran away from one. I am the child of an alcoholic who didn't get to escape. But I'm also a father who wonders what I'd do in the same situation. I'm a victim of my own mistakes, holding fast to a second chance.
I glance around the tiny Spartan room where Andrew has come for protection. We do all kinds of things to safeguard ourselves. Lie to the people we love, split hairs to justify our actions, take punishment instead of waiting for it to be given to us.
Andrew may be the one who's been charged, but we are both being tried. I hold his gaze. Andrew, I say soberly, let's start over.
Andrew. In jail, a black inmate will call a white inmate Peckerwood, Cracker, Honky, Redneck. He'll call a Mexican a Spick. A white inmate will call a black inmate a Nigger, a Monkey, a Spook, a Toad. He'll call a Mexican a Beaner. A Mexican will call a black inmate Miate, which means big black bean, or Yanta, tire, or Tadon, shark. He'll call a white inmate a gringo. In jail, everyone comes with a label. It's up to you to peel it off. The maximum security pod is made up of 15 cells. 5 white, 5 Hispanic, 4 black, and the one that holds Concise and me. Considering themselves at a disadvantage, the blacks begin a campaign to get me traded for someone with the right color skin. They stand at the entrance to the day room, waiting for an officer to come in on his habitual 25-minute walk to plead their case. I wander around the day room, not really fitting anywhere. The television is tuned to C-SPAN, one of the 5 channels we are allowed, and a reporter is discussing the good fortune of turkeys. Presidentially pardoned turkeys have reason to give thanks today, the woman says. Animal welfare activists at PETA said on Monday that Frying Pan Park in Herndon, Virginia, has promised better treatment of Katie, the female pardoned by President Bush as part of last November's holiday tradition. The second turkey pardoned died last week, after living in substandard conditions. Elephant Mike, the Aryan Brotherhood probate and control in Styx's absence, turns up the volume. Enormous and muscular, with a shaved head and a spider tattooed onto the back of his scalp, he was one of the henchmen who came with Styx to attack me in the bathroom.
"Hey, what's the address for PETA?" he says. "Maybe they can get us better conditions."
The reporter beams at the camera. Katie will be given a heated coop, more straw for bedding, extra vegetables and fruit, and some chickens in her pen for mental stimulation. Elephant Mike crosses his arms.
"Look at that. For stimulation, they get chicks, and we get spicks."
A Mexican stands up and walks past Elephant Mike, kicks his chair.
"Gringo," he mutters. "Chinga su madre."
As I walk past Elephant Mike, he grabs my shirt.
"Styx wanted me to give you a message."
I don't bother asking how Styx, a whole floor away from us and in lockdown 23 hours out of the day, might be able to get word to Elephant Mike. There are ways to communicate in jail, from talking through the ventilation ducts in the bathrooms to slipping a note to someone at an AA meeting who will carry it elsewhere. In here, you stick with your own kind.
"I thought I made it pretty clear that you aren't my kind," I reply. "I'm telling you this for your own protection."
Without responding, I start to walk away. I take 2 steps and then find myself flattened against the wall.
At any minute, a fight might break out. And when that happens, you don't want to be beside a guy who may turn on you. All I'm saying is, you're asking to get yourself in a wreck if you don't get it right, Grandpa.
A voice comes over the intercom.
"Mike, What are you doing? The detention officer asks. Dancing, he says, letting go of me. The officer sighs. Stick to the waltz. Elephant Mike shoves me and walks off. I clench my fists so that no one will realize my hands are shaking. If this were any ordinary Thursday, I would have gotten to my office by 8:30. I would have called over to Wexton Farms, the assisted living community, to see if there was anything I needed to know about. Recently hospitalized people, delays in the transit shuttle, dietary restrictions. I would have checked with the kitchen to see what was on the menu for the day and welcomed the day's entertainment. A lecturer from Dartmouth or a watercolor artist, sharing his or her passion with the seniors. I would have procrastinated by looking up news stories on the internet about you and Greta and your rescues. I would have dusted off the picture of Sophie sitting on the corner of my desk. I would spend the day with people who valued whatever time they had left, instead of people who bitterly counted it down. I head up the stairs to the cell. Concise is huddled on the floor around a cardboard box where he keeps his canteen possessions. At the sound of my footsteps, he shoves what looks like a piece of bread underneath the bottom bunk. I'm busy in here. Step. It smells like oranges in the cell. What do you know about Elephant Mike? Concise glances at me. He think he's some tank boss, but he's just doing a mud check. You know, see if you stick up for yourself or put grass under you. He seems to remember that he is not supposed to be helping me, but rather doing his best to get me into another cell. If the dogs find you in here, you're going to be hemmed up. I look down at my feet and pick up a Jolly Rancher wrapper and begin to flatten it between my palms. Don't cap it tight, I say. When he turns around, I shrug. Moonshine? That's what you're making, isn't it? Bread, oranges, hard candy. It wouldn't take a rocket scientist to figure out the chemical reaction Concise is aiming for. Do your own time, not mine, Concise scowls, and he busies himself under the bunk again. Taking my towel with me, I head toward the bathroom. The shower stalls are empty at this time of day. Emeril is about to come on the Food Network, and it is the one program that all races agree upon. I turn the corner and find Elephant Mike standing against the bathroom wall with his pants down around his knees. His eyes roll toward the ceiling. I recognize the boy kneeling in front of him, too. He calls himself Clutch and is barely old enough to grow a beard. No doubt, like me, he received Styx and Elephant Mike's warning and was offered their protection for a price, the currency of which I've interrupted. A flush works its way up from my neck. Sorry, I manage, and I leave the bathroom as fast as possible. On the television, Emeril throws garlic into a sizzling pan. Bam! He yells. I sit in the back of the day room and pretend to watch the TV, although I do not see a thing. If you pay Sheriff Jack $30 up front, you are allowed the privilege of using the canteen. Funds for these luxury items are deducted from your account. $1.50, for example, will buy you either a bottle of shampoo or a 20-ounce soda. You can buy soap that is like lye and rubs your skin raw. You can buy antihistamine and poker cards and a Spanish-English dictionary. You can buy moon pies and paydays and Pop-Tarts and trail mix. Tuna, toothbrushes, a thesaurus. Sometimes I read the canteen order form and think about who purchases what. I want to know who asks for Vic's vapor rub, if it reminds him of his childhood. I wonder who would order an eraser rather than learn from his mistakes. Or even worse, a mirror. They sell artificial tears, too. But it's hard to conceive of an inmate who doesn't have enough of his own. I share a toilet with a drug dealer. I've done business with a thrice-convicted rapist. 3 packages of cookies in return for a deck of cards. I've settled down to watch Thursday night TV beside a man who killed his wife and cut her into pieces with a Ginsu knife, stuffed the body parts into a truck toolbox, and left it in the desert. Just last year, I gave Sophie the stranger talk. Don't take candy from someone unfamiliar. Don't ever get into anyone's car except ours. Don't talk to people you do not know. Sophie, who was born in a small New Hampshire town where folks knew her by name when she walked down the street, couldn't understand the warnings. "How do you know who's a bad man?" she asked. "Can you tell just by looking?" What I should have told her at the time was, "Yes, but you have to be watching at just the right moment. Because the same man who robs a general store at knife point might, at a traffic light, turn and smile. The guy who raped a 13-year-old girl might be singing hymns beside you at church. The father who kidnapped his daughter might be living right next door. Bad is not an absolute, but a relative term. Ask the robber who used the cash he stole to feed his infant. The rapist who was sexually abused as a child. The kidnapper who truly believed he was saving a life. And just because you break the law doesn't mean you have intentionally crossed the line into evil. Sometimes the line creeps up on you, and before you know it, you're standing on the other side. Off to the right, I hear someone taking a leak. It is underscored by the scrip-scrip sound of a weapon being honed on the cement floor. A toothbrush or a wheelchair spoke being sharpened into a shank. There's weeping, too, coming from Clutch, in the cell beside ours. He has cried every night since he's been here, into his pillow, pretending no one can hear. Even more amazing, the rest of us pretend that we don't. "Concise," I whisper quietly. "Yo," he says. I realize that I don't really have a question to ask him. I just wanted to see if he is still awake, like me. You come to visit me almost every day. We sit one pane of glass apart from each other, reworking the clay of our relationship. You would think that the conversations at a jail visit are grave and furious, packed with the emotion that comes when you don't see someone for 23 hours a day. But in fact, what we talk about are the details. I soak up the descriptions of Sophie, making breakfast for herself by putting the entire box of oatmeal into the microwave. I picture the trailer where you are living. The inside is pink as a mouth. I listen to an account of Greta having her first run-in with a common snake. You hold up pictures that Sophie's drawn, so I can see the stick figure family and my crayoned place in it. For you, too, it's all about the specifics of a world you can barely remember being a part of. Sometimes, I tell you incidents that stand out in your childhood. Sometimes you have precise questions. One afternoon you ask me about your real birthday. It's June 5, I say. The silver lining is that you're almost a whole year younger than you think. I can't remember my birthdays, you muse. I thought all kids remembered their birthdays. You had parties. Pretty standard stuff. Movies, bowling, goodie bags. What about when I lived here? Well, I hedge. You were little. We didn't make a big deal about it. You frown, concentrating. I can picture a cake. It's on a tablecloth I don't remember us having in New Hampshire. You look up at me, triumphant with recollection. It fell on the floor, and I cried because we didn't get to eat it. That is the version that I fed to you when it happened. We had some of your nursery school friends over for your birthday, I say carefully. Your mother had been drinking. She was singing and dancing and making a scene, and I told her to stop it. It's a party, she said. That's what people do at parties. I told her to go lie down, that I would take care of everything. She picked up the cake and threw it on the floor, and said that if she was leaving, then the party was over. You look at me, stricken, and immediately I'm sorry I brought this up. She didn't know what she was doing back then, I say. How can you defend her? You interrupt. If Eric had ever... If he'd... You fall silent, a puzzle coming together. Along with your chin and dimples, did I give you the tendency to fall for someone dysfunctional? Would this gene be passed along to Sophie, too? I don't want to talk about this anymore, you whisper. Okay, I say. Okay. I watch you sitting on the stool, bowed by the weight of what you're starting to remember, crushed by the episodes you don't. In this new place we've found, sometimes there aren't words, because the truth can be even more difficult than the lies. I lift my palm to the glass, pretending that it would be that easy to touch you. You lift yours, too. Spread your fingers. A starfish. I picture the thousands of streets we have crossed hand in hand. Of the high fives we've exchanged after high school track meets and breathless father-daughter three-legged races. Sometimes I think my whole life has been about holding on to you. A poem circulating around D Block. A boy was born with skin pure white. He loved to fuck and he loved to fight. He was raised in the right way, stood up for his race day after day. When he grew up and became a man, he got sentenced to do life in the pen. During his sentencing, he stood straight and tall. He told the judge, "I'll do it all." So when he went down to hit the yard, others tried him, and they tried him hard. He never once lost a fight to another race. When he walked by them, they gave him his space. The off-brands didn't like this a bit, so they all got together and put out a hit. The following day, five of them tried. When the fighting was over, all five had died. All the woods got together and decorated the yard with bodies of off-brands and more than one guard. The warden tried to stop them, but peed down his leg. All the fellas laughed and made the punk beg. The governor called in the National Guard. The assholes came in to shoot Woods on the yard. They walked up to this man and saw how he was lying. It was apparent to all that he wasn't done dying. The strangest thing was, he was full of bullet holes, but not a drop of blood present from his head to his toes. He looked up then and started to laugh. He laughed at the soldiers and the prison staff. "Why can't you see that I am a saint? White's made by God. All others ain't. The reason you don't see any blood on my hide is my heart pumps nothing but pure white pride." On the wreck yard, we sort by color. Two or three men per group. The blacks play basketball. The whites stand at the far wall. The Mexicans huddle diagonally across from them. The yard isn't really a yard, more an enclosed paved square. The ceiling on top protects inmates from the fierce heat during the summer. The Swiss cheese holes in the far wall let the fresh air and the sun stream in. Someone has hung an enormous flag from the ceiling of the jail. It blocks part of the light. There is one guard for 30 men. He can't see everything. For this reason, the wreck yard is one of the prime places for a deal to go down. Cigarettes are bought surreptitiously, both real stuff and makeshift. Lettuce leaves or potato peels rolled up in pages of the Bible. The inmates who have a drug trade going make their pitches out here, too. Drugs are the only reason the colors have to interact. Looking for speed is called chasing the dragon. As I'm watching, a white called Chrome Dome makes a sale to a Mexican. He takes a Sharpie marker out of his pocket and removes the tip of it so that the buyer can inspect the goods. I'm close enough to smell the pungent vinegar scent of the black tar heroin he's got hidden inside. Clutch, the kid, straggles at the edges of the whites like an unraveling thread. He is pale and skinny, with crooked buck teeth and freckles. His eyes are locked on the basketball game. From time to time, his feet move in an imaginary play. One of the blacks dives for a loose ball, but misses. It rolls against the wall by the DO's foot and passes by in front of me. Clutch bends down and palms the basketball, spins it on one finger. He dribbles twice, the ball rising up to meet his hand magnetically. "Fool, give us the ball," says Blue Lock, one of the dominant blacks in the pod. Concise stands with his hands on his hips, sweating hard. Clutch glances around, but he doesn't relinquish the ball. When Elephant Mike walks to the perimeter of the game, Blue Lock says, "Tell your sister he better act right before he gets smacked right." Mike stands toe-to-toe with Blue Lock. "Since when do you tell me what to do?" The detention officer approaches.
"Break it up," he says.
"Man, we just flowing," Blue Lock replies. Elephant Mike knocks the ball out of Clutch's hands.
"Go wash up. You ain't touching me with those hands until you scrub off the spook that's all over you."
The ball bounces toward Concise, but I intercept it. I toss it quickly at Clutch, who automatically catches it and goes for the three-point shot. When it swishes through the net, he grins. The first time I have seen the kid smile in 3 days. "It's a game," I say. "Let him rotate in."
Blue Lock comes forward.
You talking to me?
Concise turns to him.
Yo, lay off of the pipe, cuz. Just let's go.
The play resumes, harder and faster. The detention officer goes back to a spot along the wall. When Elephant Mike walks away, Clutch looks at me.
Why did you stick up for me?
I shrug.
Because you didn't do it yourself.
Garnering respect is the same across races. Never break weak. Back the play of your brothers. Never let a woman in on the real deal. Stand strong in the face of adversity. Get one over on the system at every opportunity. Have heart. Keep your word. Because it's the only thing you've got in here. Concise is testing his hooch. As far as I can tell, he has several different bottles in various stages of fermentation. I suppose this way he can be sure of a steady income.
Do you ever think about what's going on outside? I ask.
He looks over his shoulder. I know what's going on outside. Bunch of fools watching ESPN and getting in each other's business. I mean outside, outside. In the real world. Concise sits down, his arms balanced on his knees. This is the real world, cuz. Why you think we keep coming back to it? Before I can answer, Clutch appears in the entry to our cell. He is holding a bottle of shampoo and quivering from head to toe. What's wrong? I ask. He looks like he is going to throw up.
I can't, he blurts out. And suddenly I see Elephant Mike standing behind him.
Mike grabs the bottle from Clutch and squeezes, so that human feces sprays all over me.
You want to be a nigger so bad? Rub this into your skin.
It is in my hair, my mouth, my eyes. I gasp, trying to breathe around the awful smell of it, wiping it off me and then holding out my hands, covered with shit. Concise jumps Elephant Mike as the detention officers rush into the cell. They pull Concise off Mike and throw him down into the mess on the floor.
Stupid move, Concise, the officer yells. You're 1D away from being reclassified into close custody.
Another detention officer grabs my arm and steers me out of the cell.
You need to be decontaminated, she says. I'll bring you stripes.
I turn around and see, over my shoulder, the first guard shove his knee into Concise's back to handcuff him. They think Concise did this to me, I realize. A black guy trying to make his white cellie so unhappy that he'd beg to be transferred out. They assume that Elephant Mike, the same race as me, is there because he's come to my rescue.
Wait, I say, as the guard pulls me away. Mike did it.
Concise, hauled to his feet, swings a heavy head toward me. His eyes are slitted, his jaw clenched.
Ask Clutch, I call out.
And as I am shoved toward the shower, I see the boy's head turn at the sound of his name.
These are the words we use to refer to each other. 40 ounce. Baby G. Buddha. Sea bone. Half dead. Deuce. Trigger. Tasty freak. Preacher. Snowman. Floater. Alley cat. Werewolf.
Demon. Little man. Tavo. Thumper. Bow Wow. Pinhead. Boo Boo. Ichabod. Chicago Bob. Pit Bull. Slim Jim. Die Hard. In jail, everyone reinvents himself. You would never call a guy by any name except the one he gives you. Otherwise, you might remind him of the person he used to be. Afterward, there is a pall cast over the pod. At lights out, there is hardly any conversation. Concise lies on the top bunk. Mike's on the loaf for a week, he says. The loaf is a punishment, a severe form of disciplinary segregation. In addition to being separated and locked down and stripped of privileges, inmates are fed a brick of cuisine that has everything mashed into it. All food groups and a drink. It is the penalty for assaulting staff, for having a shank found on you, for throwing blood or bodily fluids. What happened? I ask. Concise rolls over. Clutch backed you up. I figure he's counting down the 7 days along with Mike. Because on day 8, you can bet he be getting hammered. In this society, telling the truth is not rewarded, but lying to the right people is. The DO said that you could get reclassified, I say after a minute. Concise sighs. Yeah, well, whatever. They caught me cooking up some stuff a couple of times when they tossed my cell. To be moved into close custody is a bigger deal than he is letting on. Cellmates are housed alone and in lockdown for 23 hours a day, and worst of all, if you get convicted. The prison usually upholds whatever classification you had in jail. First thing in the morning, you out of here, Concise says. Clutch got an extra bunk in his cell now. I don't need this grief. A few minutes later, Concise begins to snore. I close my eyes and try to listen to the sounds in the jail. It takes me a while to realize what's missing. For the first night since he's been here, Clutch isn't crying himself to sleep. Stripes! Every morning we get a laundry call. The DO in charge swapping our towels and shorts or sheets or stripes for fresh replacements. As I walk down to the pod slider to make the exchange, I glance into Clutch's cell and see him still asleep, curled on his side in bed with a blanket pulled up to his face. Clutch, I hear over the intercom. Clutch, rise and shine. When he doesn't come out, the officer goes to his cell. Clutch, I hear the DO say. And then she calls for medical assistance. There is a lockdown while the paramedics come. They cannot perform CPR. It is impossible to dislodge the sock the Clutch is stuck so far down his throat. He is pronounced dead by one of the jail shrinks. They carry Clutch's body past our cell on a stretcher. What was his name? I ask the EMTs, but they don't answer. What was his real name? I yell. Doesn't anyone know his real name? Yo, Concise says. Sizzin' it, cuz. But I don't want to calm down. I cannot stand the fact that, under different circumstances, that might have been me. Is fate getting what you deserve?
or deserving what you get. Concise glances at me. He's better off like that, believe me. It's my fault. I turned to him, tears in my eyes. I told the DOs to talk to him. If it wasn't you, it would have been someone else. Sometime else. I shake my head. How old was he? 17? 18? I don't know. Why not? Why didn't anyone ask him where he came from? Or what he wanted to be when he grew up? Or...
Because we all know how the story ended. With a sock down your throat, or a bullet in your gut, or a knife in your back.
Concise stares at me. Some stories, they the ones no one want to hear. I sink down on the bunk, because I know it is true.
You want to know what happened to Clutch? Concise says bitterly. Once upon a time, a baby boy was born in New York City. He didn't know his daddy, who was locked up in the pen. His mama was a crack whore who moved him and his two sisters to Phoenix when he was 12, and then OD'd 2 months later. His sisters shacked up with their boyfriend's parents, and he hit the streets. The Park South Crips became his family. They fed him, clothed him, and one day when he was 16, they let him in on the action when they sweet-talked a girl into having some fun. And they all took turns with her. Come to find out later, she's 13. And a retard. That's how Clutch wound up here? No, Concise answers. It's how I did. Clutch's story. It's the same. The names are just different. Everyone in here got a story like that. Except bling blings like you. I'm not rich, I say quietly. Yeah, well, you ain't from the streets neither. What you do to get in here? I kidnapped my daughter when she was 4 years old, told her her mother was dead, and changed our identities. Concise shrugs. That ain't no crime, man. The county attorney doesn't agree. You didn't kill your daughter, did you? God, no, I say, horrified. You didn't hurt nobody. Jury'll let you go. Well, I say, maybe that's not the greatest thing. You don't want out? I try to find the right way to explain to this man how I can never go back to the way things were. How after a while you believe the fiction you've told yourself so well that you cannot remember the fact upon which it was based. It has been nearly 30 years since Charles Matthews existed. I have no idea who he is anymore. I am afraid, I admit, that it might be even harder than this. Concise looks at me for a long moment. When I got out the first time, I went to breakfast to celebrate. Found me a little diner and sat down and watched the waitress moving in her short dress. She come to take my order, and I say, I want eggs. How you want them cooked? She asked. And I just stare at her like she's speaking Martian. For 5 years, there weren't no choice. If we had eggs, they'd be scrambled, period. I knew I didn't want them like that. But I didn't remember how else they could be. I'd lost all the words. Just like that. Language, of course, vanishes like anything else in disuse. How much time before I cannot remember mercy? Before forgiveness is gone? How long will I have to be in here before I forget how possibility sits on the bridge of the tongue? I am no less bound to circumstance than Concise, or Blue Lock, or Elephant Mike, or even Clutch. I would not have run with my child if I hadn't married Elise.
I would not have married Elise if I'd been in a different bar that first night. I would not have been in that bar if my car hadn't broken down in Tempe and I needed a phone to call for a tow. I would not have been in Tempe if I weren't taking a graduate course in pharmacology. Padding my chances to get a better job with a bigger paycheck so that one day I could provide for a family I could not even yet envision. Maybe fate isn't the pond you swim in, but the fisherman floating on top of it, letting you run the line wild until you're weary enough to be reeled back in. When I look up, Concise is staring at me. "I'll be damned," he says softly. "You one of us."
This ends Disc 7.